Cape Talk, Pippa's Planet.
Now, if you were listening to John Matham's show a week or so ago, you might have heard him chatting to writer Leonie Jabir about her research on magic mushrooms. It was one of those conversations where I was in my car listening on the way home going, damn it, why didn't I get that interview? Because I literally had to sit in my car and let it finish to the very end. And we've stolen Leonie back for our show this afternoon. It's a great pleasure to welcome her to our makeshift studio today.
Hi, thanks, Pippa. Great to be here.
We're going to be talking in a little bit about one of Leonie's older books, The Hungry Season, and it touches on issues of food security and hunger. But before we go into that conversation, Leonie, you are here for a session on environmental activism this weekend. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing at Open Book.
So I'm going to be chairing a panel tomorrow with Jay Naidu and Dr. Don Pinnock and Amanda Lutwande from the Heinrich Boll Foundation, where we're going to be looking at the fact that sustainability is not just a middle-class issue. It's often seen as a middle-class issue. So the panelists will be speaking from the perspective of food security, conservation, environmental sustainability in general, and then also from the perspective of energy poverty, with the question of the nuclear court case that happened recently. So, yeah, just to try and remind policymakers that it's not a trade-off between choosing development for poverty or sustainability to protect pretty trees and nice wetlands. Actually, addressing poverty is about making sure the wetlands work and the forests breathe and the soils are healthy.
Fascinating subject. So that's tomorrow at the Fugard Theatre, 12 o'clock. Do you know if there are any tickets left?
I actually haven't looked online. Sorry, I don't know.
So I will just direct everyone, if that pricked your ears, please go to openbookfestival.co.za if you'd like to book tomorrow, 12 o'clock at the Fugard Theatre for that panel discussion. Now, food security came up earlier this week when we had our consumer slot on Wednesday with Wendy Lola talking about expiry dates and how much food that is perfectly edible and perfectly good ends up being thrown away. And I thought that was a nice jumping point into your book, The Hungry Season, which is all about this issue, published back in 2012 by Picador Africa, and every bit as relevant today as it was then. The quandary is, as a planet, Leonie, we are producing enough food for everybody living on this planet, aren't we?
We are indeed. The problem is what we do with that food and how we process that food. So the calories that come out of the soil are healthy, fantastic calories, packed with nutrients, good energy. But the industrial food system we put it through strips those calories of their goodness. And basically what you often end up in the city particularly is highly processed, very sugary, but nutritionally dead calories. So it's a waste, it's a waste of all the environmental resources that went into producing those calories in the first place. So we do need to look at how this industrial food system is producing food that might taste interesting, but isn't actually good for us. And the result is we end up particularly in the city context with this food. We are surrounded with food. We're surrounded by calories, but they're not necessarily calories that are good for us. And the result, often the health implications, it's often invisible because we get sick and we get heavy. And because we look like we're well-nourished, we think we're healthy, but actually we're not. We're malnourished.
You've described that as the poverty paradox, that hungry doesn't necessarily equal sin, that you can be malnourished and food insecure and present as a large person.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, from the perspective of the dominant, how big business dominates the food system and kind of structures the system around us, that gives us very little healthy choices, particularly for poorer people. That locks us into poverty. You know, if you're a child and you don't get the right micronutrients from the moment you're conceived until you reach about the age of two, that's when something like 80% of your brain is built. And you take that brain with you through the rest of your life. So no matter how good the nutrition is after the age of, say, five, it doesn't make any difference. You've got the brain that you had in those first few years. It's like building a house with really bad cement and concrete. You will always have a weak structure. So if kids don't get the right nutrition when they're really little, they are locked into a development pathway for the rest of their lives.
And of course, they then enter the further cycle in adulthood that if you don't have enough to eat, you lack energy, it's difficult to go out and find work to carry on with the cycle of daily living.
Absolutely.
You then aren't earning money, so you can't buy more food to solve that problem, and it's a vicious cycle.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the World Bank put out a figure a while ago where they said that kind of micronutrient malnutrition in the early stages of life can lead to you losing about 10% of your earning potential later in life. Save the Children in the UK actually said that was 20% of your earning potential. And as you know, this isn't just about people being, you know, units of earning potential in the economy. It's about self-actualization. It's about giving their kids the best opportunities.
I think it's worth taking a step back to talk about what we actually mean by the term food security, because a lot of people might just think, well, it's having access to food to eat. It's lots more than that, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, often when people think about food security, they just think about calories coming out of the farm, you know, food production from agriculturalists. Actually, it's about everyone having access to healthy, nutritious food and food that is culturally appropriate to them. And when you think about the city context, and since most of us are urbanized now, that means in order to have access to food, you have to be geographically close to food. You have to have money to buy that food. So we talk about the geography of the city, how supermarkets and how the informal food markets move around the city, whether people have a job or a social grant in order to access that food system. It's very complex. It's very, very complex.
If you've just joined us late to the conversation, my guest joining us in our makeshift studio is science writer Leonie Joubert, talking particularly about her 2012 book, The Hungry Season, Feeding Southern Africa's Cities, but on the greater issue of food security. You've mentioned the city repeatedly, and one of the things I found fascinating in this book, if you've not read it, Leonie basically over each chapter visits with a different family and looks at what they're eating and their access to food. And one of the issues that is raised is how diet changes with urbanization. So you were speaking to Ogogo, whose life in the rural Eastern Cape and whose diet in that context was so vastly different from what it's like in the city today. You've already mentioned access to the highly processed, highly sugary foods. But there's more to it than that. It's also about cultural norms, it's about aspirations.
So firstly, it's very difficult to define precisely what a traditional diet is, because in South Africa, because of colonialism, we've seen the traditional diet change so much over time. I think what's important is to consider that a slightly more rural diet is often food that is closer to what it looks like when it comes from the ground. So even if it is maize, which is not an indigenous grass to South Africa, if you're growing it yourself, you're eating a less processed maize. If you move to the city, you are eating a very highly refined maize that's basically just sugar. When people move to the city, there are these cultural attitudes towards food, and this isn't just a South African thing. In fact, the World Health Organization and the medical community at large has done some interesting research, just looking at attitudes towards processed, packaged, branded food versus these traditional foods. And around the world, when people move to cities, they want to leave behind the peasant foods of their parents. I mean, it's a very pejorative language. People look down on the parents' type of food, and they want to eat branded foods because it's a status symbol. And that is a product of big food. They have massive amounts of money, budget, to drive the marketing campaigns that convince people that you are higher status if you have the following brand in your grocery basket. And that brand might not necessarily be healthy for you.
It's often very unhealthy for you. I mean, I was fascinated to read in this book that that South Africa, for example, has been an absolute goldmine market for McDonald's. They arrived here, they opened up outlets at a rate that they've never seen anywhere in the world before, because there has been just such embracing of all of the things that are embodied in that brand. And as you said, the rejection of what once would have eaten growing up, for example. Somebody has SMS just asking you to elaborate on what you meant by healthy, nutritious, culturally acceptable food. Obviously, face value, you wouldn't want to feed pork to somebody who chooses not to eat pork in terms of their faith. Well, can you give us a few more examples of how that plays out?
So healthy and nutritious, basically food that looks close to what it was when it came out of the ground or off the farm. As soon as it becomes highly processed, it's losing its health potential. I don't want to get into the whole carbohydrate versus fat thing, but increasingly we are seeing a consensus around the world that processed carbohydrates are basically just sugar and are actually really bad for us. They contribute to heart disease, to diabetes, to a whole series of lifestyle-related illnesses. And incidentally, lifestyle-related illnesses are overtaking communicable diseases as the big healthcare burden for us. So that's a huge issue. So we do need to be moving back towards healthier fats, whole grain foods, whole foods. And that's the one thing. And obviously, culturally appropriate depends, obviously.
On the context.
Absolutely,
yeah. Okay, thanks for that SMS. Interesting WhatsApp in from Amanda in Milnerton. He says, I saw that the Department of Agriculture is urging people to grow urban food gardens to help with food security. But how do we do that in the middle of a drought?
Okay, that's a very good question. And all too often, particularly at a city level, we see the food security policy is just about, well, let's just get poor people to grow their own food. That'll fix it.
Fix everything. Mm.
It fails almost every time. And the reason is because the people, and this is partly to do with the apartheid geography of the city. Poorer people live on the far ends of the city. They're already taxed by the fact that they have to travel long distances to work. They earn a pittance, and then they spend most of their money on transport. Mm. Now, you cannot expect a mother who spends so many hours, a full day at work, 2 hours traveling to work, 2 hours traveling from work, to then go home and spend 3 hours cooking a healthy meal for her kids. It's completely, like, it's just not possible. Mm. So food gardens, it's a great idea in some contexts. It has to be a very specific model. In fact, Abalimi Bezakaya here in Cape Town is an interesting model because the producers get 50% of the product goes home with them, so nutrients. 50% gets sold, so they get an income. So they can do both. That is why it works. They need assistance reaching the market. Mm. But to just hope that people are going to solve their nutritional issues because they're suddenly going to miraculously produce another 5 hours every day. And then, of course, you mentioned the issue of water. Mm. The issue of water is fascinating. I don't know if we have time to talk about that now.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so from the Cape Town context, we now have, apparently we have something like 2 times the amount of water we need for the city falls across the Cape Flats and the City Bowl. But now 500 years ago, that would all have percolated down into the Cape Flats aquifer. But now most of the city is just paved over with tar and concrete and whatever. You have these highly designed stormwater infrastructure systems to take water from here and ship it way out to sea and dump it there. So that's all water that's not percolating down into the ground. Mm. Now, you have somewhere like the Philippi Horticultural Area. It's a 3,000-hectare area of relatively undeveloped land. Whether or not it's agriculturally productive isn't the point. It is a green spot in a part of the city that has very few green spots left. Now, keeping green spots across the city is a way of making a city climate resilient. So green spots, whether it's a little bit of leftover wetland, a little bit of grassland, a little bit of forest, it during drought, it can buffer heat waves and heat extremes and drought. During winter time, it can just help hold water and percolate it down rather than capturing it, having it run off hard surfaces very quickly, causing lots of damage to infrastructure as it goes, picking up lots of pollutants, causing damage. So we need to make decisions as a city that is about making the city surface as porous as possible so it captures, holds, percolates water down into the ground. It's a very easy thing to do if you make clever planning decisions. But once you've made a planning decision that calls for development, it's very difficult to then
retrieve it.
Yeah, to reverse engineer back to something that is more water friendly. So the Cape Flats aquifer has potential to provide quite a significant amount of water if we do two things. If all of Cape Town is much more water wise, so if we make our current restrictions almost a permanent state of being, so we need much less water, and then we make our hard surfaces softer and porous so that we can recharge places like these aquifers. The aquifer, incidentally, so apparently Cape Town loses something like 20% of its stored water, surface stored water, to evaporation.
Whoa.
It's actually 18% specifically, but now if you consider that the Cape Flats aquifer is in fact a dam, it's an underground dam, it's not going to lose any of that water to evaporation. So we need to make sure that the aquifer can get recharged, but it needs to be recharged in a way that's clean so the water isn't polluted. So we just need clever decisions, long-term decision-making from politicians who are not concerned about the next electoral cycle.
Where do we find those? Unfortunately, they're short in supply, aren't they? Related question, it's a great question on our SMS line from Paul, wanting to know, are there any inspiring examples you can cite of cities or governments that are playing an active role in their food systems rather than leaving food provision to the private sector? And I guess we could extrapolate that from not only the food systems but also the water planning. Who are the gold standards we can look to?
Hmm. I actually can't think of cities themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, and I wish that some of the people that I get my information from were here, because they would have this at their fingertips. But I do think the private sector needs to take responsibility for its role in the food system much more. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that comes through in a lot of the obesity-related literature is this idea that the private sector has been allowed to self-regulate. So, for instance, there's very little restriction on how much sugar is put into our food, for instance. People say they don't want a nanny state where the state tells us how much we can and can't eat. Well, we're effectively already nannied, but by the private sector. So an example, let's say hypothetically around, sorry, and I'm not answering that question because I think I can't, but an example is, for instance, peanut butter. Now, at the moment, there's no restriction on how much added hidden sugar you can put into peanut butter.
Yep.
The more sugar you get exposed to, the more your palate becomes numb to it, so the more you want to get the same feel good factor. So you put on the highly sugared peanut butter, and then you add syrup on top of that because you want the kick. So if you had a system where the state restricted how much sugar could be added to in a hidden form, you would protect people from being overexposed to sugar that they weren't aware of. And yes, you can ask people to take responsibility for their own consumption, but only to a point. You know, a lot of the food labeling is so obtuse. The names for sugar, for the hidden sugar, I mean, they're just incomprehensible. So you can't just expect people to be educated enough. And also, let's not go into the whole education thing.
I'm so glad you touched on the food labeling, because I was having a chat with Wendy Nola about doing a show on exactly that in a few weeks' time, and I'll ask you about that. It's one thing to encourage people to even make the effort to read the label, but if they can't digest and interpret what they're seeing there, there is no point. Somebody asking about the role of alcohol, and I'm very glad you asked that, because, of course, tomorrow is Fecal Alcohol Syndrome Day, so it's something you do touch on in the book with a visit to Da'ar. Any comments on, the role that plays in this problem?
We could actually do a whole show on that. And it's interesting, I signed up to a sobriety group recently because I'm also interested in just how normalized alcohol consumption is. And I also want to radically change my own relationship with alcohol because I think I drink a little bit too much. Most of us do. And it's basically just another form of sugar as well. But what is interesting is particularly with mothers who are very poorly nourished, in very poor communities, those particularly who have a very low body weight, a tiny, tiny amount of alcohol can have very serious repercussions for any fetus that they're carrying. So again, you kind of end up with these terrible negative feedback loops. You're undernourished at a food perspective, you're vulnerable to the toxin in your body and how that impacts on your baby's brain development. Interestingly enough, I saw a little bit of research recently which made a correlation between malnutrition in that first sort of 2,000 days and violence later in life, domestic violence later in life. Basically, there was a link between the brain not developing properly in the infant results in a lack of impulse control later in life. And so it becomes part of this negative feedback loop. And there's been some fascinating research in Diepsluit, which the Mail and Guardian has written about extensively, about this link between children born into deprivation and poverty and how that produces violence later in life. And it just becomes this negative feedback loop. And alcohol is one of the main drivers in all of that. And the less well-nourished you are, the less your body is able to deal with that poison when it's in the system.
And we wonder why we're sitting with increasing levels of violence in our society.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I wish we had 3 hours to chat to you. just a quick SMS here from Mariette saying, food labeling, the PHA, that's the Philippi Horticultural Area, etc., would be helpful to have all retailers disclose where our food actually comes from, so that you could make a choice to buy hyper-local, I guess, the extrapolation. I mean, is that a realistic goal?
I think it's perfectly doable. It just requires some political will. There's a lovely example in Europe about how, in order to get away from fresh produce-related food waste, supermarkets were driving this idea of eat ugly food, ugly fruit.
Yes, I remember it, yeah. And wonky carrot.
Exactly, yeah. Brilliant idea. And I think we could do something very similar. You know, if our local supermarket system, made a deliberate choice to go and buy from Philippi, and then labeled it and said, celebrate local, celebrate our local farmers, and then also kind of overcame any issues that might happen around, fruit doesn't look perfect. But at the same time, we also need a concerted effort to look after the farmers there. There's a very, very high crime rate there, which makes it quite dangerous and economically challenging for farmers to survive.
It's been a fascinating conversation, Leonie. Thanks so much for joining us today. Great to have you with us, Leonie Jabeur. If you're interested in hearing more of her insight into environmental issues, a reminder that she's on as part of the Open Book Festival tomorrow at the Fugard Theatre at 12 o'clock.